Welcome, everyone. This is Molly Rowan Leach, and I am your co-host, along with ABA best-selling author of Lawyers as Peacemakers and founder of CuttingEdgeLaw.com, J. Kim Wright. And we've been just thrilled to host this ongoing series for evolutionary lawyers. And this archive presents to you the incredible Honorable Judge Peggy Hora. Judge Hora has a very extensive background, and you can find out more about her at judgehora.com. We enter into this conversation with her and went in a lot of different compelling directions about her background and everything that is happening in the practice of law from her perspective. So enjoy this archive, and for more information about Judge Hora, once again, go to judgehora.com. And also more on this series and our archives at cuttingedgelaw.com. Thank you.
Things in our calls as we give a brief introduction and then ask you to tell your story. And I've heard your story, and I think it's fascinating. One of the things that we were talking about, and I'll say this by way of introduction, when Molly and I were preparing this, she said that Judge Hora looks like she does a lot. That she must have a very brilliant mind, and one of my favorite job descriptions that you have had is that of thinker in residence. Which has lingering ramifications in Australia, and you've also had a very interesting career in legal services, and then being a judge and being one of the pioneers really in bringing problem-solving courts to the world. So yeah. I welcome you very much, and would love for you to tell us just a bit about what you want us to know about you and how you got here, and we're going to have some conversation about it.
Well, it's in some ways a peculiar story because everything I did wrong, except it all turned out right. So you're not supposed to get married at 17 and have kids and not go to college and still end up where I did, but that's exactly what I did. And then when I was 24, it's when I went to college for the first time, and my youngest went to kindergarten. So we did our homework together for the next, what seemed like, 43 years. And then I graduated from law school in 1978 and went to work for the Legal Aid Society of Alameda County, where I'd been an intern for a couple of years at that point. I eventually became managing attorney at the Hayward office. And then one of my favorite judges on the local bench kept not acting like he was running for re-election. He wasn't doing the things he should have been doing. So I went into his chambers one day and said, "Judge, are you going to run for re-election? Because you need to get going, and I'm happy to help you if you are. But if you're not, would you let me know first? Because I'd like to do it." And he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll let you know third. I'll tell my wife first, my former partner second, and I'll let you know third." I said, "Okay." So one day, soon thereafter, I get a phone call from the judge saying I'm not running, and I'm telling the rest of the world tomorrow. So I had a one-day jump on it, and jump I did. I put together this entire campaign based upon all the community work I had done and stuff I'd done in local politics. And here was this 38-year-old legal aid lawyer, woman, and there'd never been such a thing on that bench before, and the three men who ran against me in the June race were busy fighting with each other because they completely dismissed my ability to do anything. And instead, I got the endorsement of the local paper, which was very conservative and surprised everybody, but the part they didn't know was the conservative publisher was out of town the day I was interviewed, and the assistant editor who interviewed me had been my journalism colleague up at Cal State Hayward. And so I got the endorsement. I got the endorsement of the police, Association, which also surprised everybody. But the trick there was, they're a labor union, and I knew how to talk to labor unions. And it just all fell. I had Republicans and Democrats and people who'd never worked with each other before, you know, and I had the ecologists and the cops and the feminists and all these people working together. And the other wonderful thing about running for judge is you can't endorse a non-judicial candidate. So everybody who was running that year all endorsed me, and I didn't have to endorse any of them or choose between them and alienate the two out of the three. So in the June race, I got 42% of the vote, much to everyone's surprise. And then the man who was left standing, I just creamed him in the general election. I got something like 63% of the vote. And I remember that in 321 precincts, I won in 318. And I did it the old-fashioned way by walking precincts. And I walked over 100, and my supporters walked over 100. And just did all the things you do in a political campaign. And that's how I became the first woman judge elected in 1984 in what was then Samuel Andrew Haywood Municipal Court. So I got there, and having had a legal aid background, as you can imagine, I didn't know diddly from squat about criminal law, so of course that's the assignment they gave me. And so I quickly learned the penal code and some procedures, and criminal lawyers talk in numbers, and civil lawyers talk in cases, so I had to learn all these numbers. You know, it's a 484, and I'd say, just a moment, to look in the penal code and find out that was petty theft. It's a 187, that's murder. You know, all these numbers, which sticks to me to this day. I recently moved into a condominium complex, and my neighbors all have three numbers. All our units are numbered. And so there's the terrorist threats up on the fourth floor, and, you know, it's funny, I still relate to the numbers. So that first year of criminal law, I did what I thought you were supposed to do. People would plead guilty, would be found guilty, and I'd send them to jail and tell them not to use alcohol or other drugs anymore. And I'd literally wag my finger at them. That was really useful. And they'd come back, and I'd send them back to jail, and they'd come back. And finally, at the end of the year, I said to my probation officer, does anyone ever do what I tell them to do? And he says, yeah. I said, will you bring me one? Because I was so tired of seeing failures. I just had this vision of 20 years of engaging in useless acts. And I said, I can't do this. This is nuts. And what makes these folks different from me? What am I doing that is not getting the response that I want? So I started taking classes in chemical dependency and then smacked my brow with my hand and said, ah, now I get it. Everything we're doing is wrong. And there was born, along with many other judges in the United States, the drug court movement, saying we have to learn how to do a better job. And about 4 years into that or so, a colleague from Kalamazoo, Michigan, named Judge Bill Schnee, and I were talking about doing a law review article, and we were exploring therapeutic jurisprudence and how that might fit in with drug courts. And we concluded that actually that was the foundation of drug courts. But we called David Wexler and Bruce Linnick and said, we're going to be in Washington at a conference. Could we possibly meet with you? So they came up from Miami and out from Arizona. And we all sat down, and that was sort of the birth of the combination of TJ and drug treatment courts. And as you know, it's gone on from there. I've stayed active, of course, in the national movement, but also been privileged to do many things internationally. Right after I retired, the State Department sent me to Israel to meet with the new Chief Justice and talk about establishing drug courts in Israel, of which there's one now. And my work in Australia, more about which I'll talk in a moment. And then most recently, and what I'm very excited and proud about, as I've been working for a couple of years with judges in New Zealand to set up their first adult alcohol and other drug treatment course. And in June, such will open. Parliament has approved it, it's funded it, and folks, including myself, are going in March to do the training for the drug court teams. And that will be, I think, the 20th country that will have drug courts now. So back to Australia and how that happened.
Well, I want to stop you just for a minute to back up just a little bit. There may be a few people on the call who don't understand how drug courts are different or what drug courts are. And so if you could give us a taste of that, and then also you're usually the person I go to when I want to know how many there are. And so you say there are 20 countries. You know, how many of these courts are there now as far as you know?
About 2,500 drug courts, another 1,100 problem-solving courts in the United States. So quite a few. Essentially what a drug court is, and all problem-solving courts essentially, is look at the issues that are bringing people to court in the first place and then attempting to address those issues with the idea of getting people to change their behavior and live crime-free lives or get their kids back or whatever the focus of the court is. And it's a combination of incentives and sanctions with emphasis on the incentives we've learned over the years. That finger wagging thing I did just was not useful at all. And sending them to jail over and over again was obviously not useful at all. You know, if you look at the statistics, it's shocking. 2 out of 3 people who've been in state prison go back within 3 years. So obviously incarceration is not the answer for behavioral change. Somebody said, and I have stolen it, that we have to work with and treat the ones we're only mad at and save incarceration for the ones who scare us. You know, that we need to really focus on helping people get through their problems. Now, in the U.S., we call them problem-solving courts. In Australia, for instance, they don't like that term because the court can't solve your problem, so they call it solution-focused courts. We have problem-solving courts because that's what the Conference of Chief Justices decided to call them. So, you know, who's going to argue with them? So a drug court is set up with various criteria for entry. Someone comes in, and what they're agreeing to do, usually in a post-plea situation now, is work on treatment and recovery. And everybody's there to support that person's journey, and it is a long journey through recovery or to get to mature recovery from alcohol and other drug use that are causing problems in the person's life. So the emphasis is not on winning the case for the prosecution. The emphasis is not on, quote, getting the client off, unquote. The emphasis is not on the judge, you know, sitting there calling the balls and strikes and running a trial. The emphasis is everybody working together, treatment, community corrections, law enforcement, prosecution, defense, lawyers, social workers sometimes. There can be any number of people in the teams, all focused on helping this person get through what is a very, very difficult process. And if you understand the brain chemistry of addiction, it is an incredible thing that happens to our brains when that switch flips from user to addict, alcoholic. And the people who manage to go through that and to stay in recovery are the most amazing people in the world. I have such admiration for them because it's certainly harder than anything I've ever done. So that's what a drug court does. It focuses on frequent meetings with the judge, status reports. It also has staffing, meaning everybody talks about the cases and the issues before coming. The judge comes out to the bench and makes recommendations to the judge on a decision of what should be the incentive, what should be the sanction, does it need a treatment response, that sort of thing. It also relies on these people having special training and interest in being there. you know, nothing worse than forcing somebody to do something totally foreign to them if they don't want to. And there are judges and lawyers and everybody else who say, don't give me that. So that would be their worst nightmare, is to be put in the drug court. By contrast, for me, I don't know if I would have stayed on the bench wagging my finger and sending those people back over and over again for the 20 years if it hadn't have been for drug court and finding a better way to do business. So
in fact, you've done research on that, or you've written about that, the job satisfaction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, interestingly, and I guess it's not totally surprising, there's very little done on, very little known about judicial satisfaction. It's sort of, what are you talking about? You get the good parking place, you get to wear the robe and tell people what to do, what's not to be satisfied. But as it turns out, judges in regular calendars are a pretty unhappy lot and quite frustrated with their lot. And judges who are in problem-solving courts are just the happiest little judges in the world. Colleague Dr. Deborah Chase and I did a series of surveys, which at that time was the largest number of judges who'd ever been surveyed. And we got 100% agreement from drug court judges, criminal drug court judges, on various questions like, do you think that people can change for the better? That sort of thing. And the most serious thing, the thing we did not expect, we knew that judges affected the participants in court, but what we didn't know is how much the judge was affected by them. So, for instance, if a judge answered that she felt the people were grateful for the court process and sort of improving their lives, then that judge was more likely to express judicial satisfaction. So it was from the other side of the bar towards the bench that we didn't know we were going to find, which is kind of interesting. So we did a series of three articles, the first one comparing drug court judges, adult criminal drug court judges, with family law, the second, unified family courts, a more TJ approach to family law with regular family law lawyers, and then the drug court judges with regular judges on a criminal assignment. And, yeah, that satisfaction part is really quite amazing. And that constant interaction between the participant and the judge, we know from the participant's point of view, they all say, not all, over 85% say, if it hadn't been for the judge, they wouldn't have stayed in the program. If it had been run by a probation officer or something else, there's sort of these programs now that are drug court-like. They're not really drug court. They say, well, you know, probation can do this. You don't need a judge to do this. But in fact, you do. And the research that's come out of NPC in Portland supports that. They've looked at the 10 key components of drug court and done actual cost analyses and recidivism studies on what happens, for instance, if the judge spends 3 minutes per person. Well, your recidivism rates go down. I mean, it's kind of astounding just by spending the time. So I don't remember what your question is, but there's the answer.
Okay. Yes.
We do have someone that would like to ask a question. Is this a good time to open it up?
Sure, sure. And just to remind anybody else who wants to ask a question or make a comment, just press 1 and it'll show up on our screens and we'll know.
And I also just would like to invite Judge Hora, if you wouldn't mind pulling back if you're on a speakerphone, just slightly from the receiver. We're getting just a little bit of feedback that might be a little difficult for people to hear. So,
I'm sorry. There's my big voice again.
Yeah, that's okay. And also, I'll just take a moment to mention to everyone that Judge Hora's website is judgehora.com for for those
very
who are interested
named,
in finding.
You must admit.
And so we have a hand up. Mark, you're live. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Your Honor, I want to tell you what you're saying is fascinating to me. It never dawned on me that there's judges who could look at the law holistically. But
well, we're not all Neanderthals, dear.
I just wanted to ask you one question. You mentioned something about having a conference with some judges, one of which came from Miami. I was wondering, who was that judge?
The judge who sort of started it all was Herb Goldstein.
Goldstein?
A second there. Yeah, he sort of started the whole thing. It came out of Florida because the Chief Justice was seeing the numbers of cases based on crack cocaine at the time and all the stuff that was going on. Now, this was in the late 80s, and says there's got to be a better way to do business. So he actually released a judge for a year who went around the country talking to people and saying, how can we do better? Herb, oh, boy. Sorry, Herb, wherever you are, I've forgotten your last name. And he came back, and actually Goldstein was the first judge to do it. That was 1989, and then the second court was in Oakland, California, and I chaired the committee that set up that court, and then Judge Jeffrey Tauber was the one who presided over it. He then went on to become the first CEO of National Association of Drug Court Professionals. So, you know, it's all very incestuous. We all know one another, except now you go to a conference, there's 3,800 people. And in the old days, I remember when we had a T-shirt made up that said, the first 100, that was the first 100 drug courts in the country. So that was the judge, bless his heart, and he's gone now in Miami.
Well, and Mark, if you'll go to Cutting Edge Law and to the menu under courts, you'll actually find that there are, not only did I interview Judge Hora, but there's several judges in South Florida that are now operating problem-solving courts, including Jerry Beth Cohen, who I was introduced to by Judge Hora.
And
Judge Cohen
is the premier United Family Treatment Court person in the world. She knows more about reuniting families who have these problems, and of course child abuse and neglect, about 80% of which has its genesis in alcohol and other drugs. And Ginger Lerner Wren, who is the first judge to set up a mental health court in the United States. All Floridians.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Well, you were telling us some things. I interrupted you, Judge Hora. Is there something else that you wanted us to know about?
Well,
I have lots of questions.
What a drug court is.
Okay.
I did remember the question. It's what's a drug court and how many are there? And you know, that's sort of the latest. And they're in surprising and wonderful places. They're not all English speaking. A lot in the Caribbean, which is sort of interesting, and Bermuda. There's one being explored in Malta. I recently responded to an inquiry from the Ukraine. So it's sort of popping all over the place. I did a speech in the Netherlands a couple years ago, and they're very interested in looking at these sorts of courts. So it's definitely an idea that's appealing to various cultures, because, to no one's surprise, it's pretty much the same darn issues that bring people to court all over the world. And although there are cultural differences, those little addicted brains are the same all over the world. And the structure and what happens and, you know, the way they light up with stimuli while looking at a PET scan, you know, all are pretty much the same. So we've developed a really good program, I think, and another resource for the listeners, very proud of it, only took us 8 years, to publish a judge's bench book, and it's not just for judges. It has chapters on things like testing, motivational interviewing, legal issues, and so forth. And it's the judge's drug course judge's bench book, and it can be found at nvci.org. That's the National Drug Court Institute. If you go under the tab that says publications.
That's great. One of the things that I've just caught in the newspapers as I travel around the country is in both Minnesota and Colorado, I saw that they had closed prisons because, and when they were interviewing the people, you know, the news media just said, well, why? In both cases, they said, well, we just don't have the recidivism anymore because of these drug courts. And,
it's pretty astounding. Yeah, the Denver story is interesting because one of the first courts was set up by Judge Bill Meyer in Denver. He was, I don't know, seventh or something, still single digits in any event. And after he retired, one of his colleagues, who had never supported the idea of the court and had written all these law review articles, the drug court scandal was one of them. He succeeded in having the drug court shut down. So for the 3 years it was down, surprises, surprises to no one, the crime rates went up, recidivism rates went up, and so forth, and the sheriff and the district attorney went to the court and begged to get the drug court back. You know, it wasn't the defense bar that came and begged, it was the, quote, law enforcement side. And that was a great lesson we learned with the horrible thing that happened in Denver that should have never been shut down, but that's history now. And those kinds of stories are just, you know, all over the place. That's one of the great things about drug courts. If you want to just spend, you know, 20 minutes getting incredibly inspired, or if you're like me, you'll well up. Of course, I'm at the age now where I cry at cat food commercials. But if you go to NADCP.org, that's the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, and click on some of the clips from this year's training conference. There's a man who has a PhD and is graduated with honors for his bachelor's, his master's, and his PhD that does a speech that will just knock your socks off. He's a drug court graduate, and another graduate who's now the public defender in the drug court of Denver, where he was once a participant. And just gives you chills up and down your spine, those stories. And of course, you know, seeing people actually being able to get hold of their lives and live the life they really want and live a life that people in the criminal justice system seem to end up living.
It looks like we have another question. Okay. Good time to open it up again?
Yes.
Sure.
All right. Janet, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Judge Hora. Thank you. I actually was involved in work like this from a different perspective, from a social work and psychiatric social work perspective in Philadelphia back in the mid-70s.
Great.
And one of the things that we saw was that there was a shift as the whole drug usage changed and the drugs of choice changed, and there was a real shift here in how the courts dealt with these kinds of issues. And I'm just wondering if you've seen these courts implemented in any large cities, and in particular in any large cities in the East Coast.
Oh, sure. The when Judith Kaye was the chief judge of New York, she mandated drug courts in every county. So New York has probably the largest integrated system of drug courts of any state. You can name any city up and down the coast, from Newark to Philly to, you know, someplace in South Carolina that have drug courts. So yes, they're all over huge cities, and sometimes, you know, five or six courts in the same city, such as San Francisco. Yes, they work urbanly, if that's a word, and they work in rural areas. I mentioned mental health courts. There are six academy courts, which are chosen based upon their procedures and the way they operate and so forth. and one of them is run by a friend of mine in Albany, Georgia, which is rural southeast Georgia with, you know, like 3 cents for resources, and yet he's an academy court. He runs an academy court. So some very resource-poor areas to, you know, the big city where you can find 100 different AA meetings a week, you know, speaking Urdu and sign language, it can be done anywhere. And part of it is absolutely the role of the judge, but certainly the understanding of the team of what the goal is, of what the process is, and respect for the participant and giving them the support they need to make healthy choices.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Judge Hora, we sometimes talk about a paradigm shift, and it seems to me that that has to happen with the judge to have one of these courts that's really effective. And would you agree? And if so, how would you describe that shift?
Well, I think so. Although what's interesting is, of course, in the beginning, all of us chose to be there. We were the driving force. We were the ones that quote, chose the assignment, if you will. That began to shift, of course, as people moved on, did other things, or presiding judges decided somebody had been in an assignment long enough. So we then began to see judges who weren't particularly thrilled to be there. And sometimes that's incredibly negative, but usually not. They sort of grow into the job, and when they see the changes that are being made and that actually what they're doing is useful and appropriate, and I always reminded judges that not so much now, everybody accepts, not everybody, many people accept the drug court model, but I used to remind them when they were saying, well, it won't work in one state, well, that's not what your Chief Justice thinks, because the Chief Justices voted 50-0 to support problem-solving court in the very first resolution in 2001. So obviously, you know, it's something that the Chief Justices have approved of, given their imprimatur, and is appropriate for people to do. So judges kind of go into it. One of the interesting pieces of research that NPC did was they looked at judges who came back to the assignment after a period of being away, and every single one of them had more effectiveness the second time. So it's not only a paradigm shift to think of, you know, I'm not just the, you know, referee sitting here ruling on objections, but rather I'm an involved, I'm a huge participant in this process, but also they learn how to do it better as time goes on. So you see better recidivism rates, you see more cost effectiveness when judges are doing it for the second time. And some of those projections or the statistics are really, really amazing how much better they did the second time around. So it does take a whole new way of thinking about things. There's still judges who say, and I've heard a million times, well, I'm not a social worker. And certainly, that's true, and we're not asking you to be a social worker. What we're asking you to do is listen to the social worker who knows a heck of a lot more about social work than you do. Listen to the treatment professional. Listen to the public safety concerns of the prosecutor. Listen to the due process concerns of the defense attorney. Listen to the community corrections officer who says, you know, something's going on. I'm not sure what it is yet, but I was by there the other night. Something's happening. You know, there's some changes being made, and I don't know that they're through the positive. And then the judge has a decision with all sorts of information. It is shocking to most people how little information we have when we make decisions, whether it's a bail decision or whether or not somebody's getting out of custody, a sentencing decision. We just don't have all the information we need. And certainly, in a treatment court, you have more information about these folks than you will ever know about any other defendant in a criminal context. Absolutely. And so it's a paradigm shift away from the way things have been and your role and onto something else that is incredibly satisfying. And just to make clear, it's not as if I did that on a full-time basis. I had drug court on Thursday afternoon. In the meantime, I had preliminary hearings, I had trials, I had pre-trials. You know, I did everything that a, quote, regular judge does. It's just that for one afternoon a week, I got to do something that was very special.
Well, and Judge Hora, I know you kind of objected to my characterization of modern-day Gandhis. The series is, you know, for the people that are rock stars, if you prefer that. You know, where do you get the energy, the motivation, and the inspiration for doing this work?
Well, see, I'm not nearly a good enough person to be called Gandhi, but a rock star who once in a while tears up the hotel room, I can live with that image. just a little bit, just a little bit. Well, the motivation comes from the people themselves. I mean, when you see these folks, when you see them get their kids back, and you know that those children's lives are going to be better off with their functional parents than they will ever be in foster care. The whole foster care system, don't get me started. Which is not to say that the people who provide foster care, many of them are heroes, and I don't know what we'd do without them. But to see somebody who's never had a job in their life and has been living on the street go from that to graduating from college. I'm thinking of a woman named Sharon who would wash her hair in the hose of a neighbor near the railroad tracks where she slept and had been on the streets for like 3 or 4 years at that point. And women on the streets do not have easy lives, which is not to imply that men do, but women are incredibly vulnerable to victimization on the street. So just to see people make that change. And then the other part of it is absolutely in believing that this is an appropriate and effective way to do it. You know, I just want to tell every judge who will sit still for 10 minutes. And the motivation comes from the seeds that you plant. Now, I've been teaching at the National Judicial College for almost 20 years now. Those judges have gone out and touched goodness knows how many lives in the course of their career. To know that something you do in a very small way can affect thousands of people multiplied times goodness knows how many judges that I've been able to teach and have contact with just makes it all worthwhile. And then finally, I guess, it's just sort of an internal combustion energy because I love it. I just love doing it. I love teaching about it. I love watching judges interact. I still sit on assignments from time to time, so I get to go back oftentimes in problem-solving courts, often to go back and be on the bench, you know, for a week at a time, something like that. If it's much more than a week at a time, it's too much like work, and so I don't like to do that because now that I'm retired, of course, I have no idea how I had time to do a full-time job.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, because I watch you on Facebook, I watch you on the TJ list, and you travel more than I do, and it all seems to be work-related.
The difference, Kim, is I travel in first class. I have so many miles, I get bumped up almost all the time. What am I doing? I just published with co-author Brian Chadrow a chapter on DWI treatment perspective, and we talk a lot about the DWI courts, and a new publication on criminal justice and treatment. That just came out, within the last month or so. I think I finished all my law review writing, and I really don't want to ever do one again with 523 footnotes. But I felt that I had to bring credibility to the movement, if you will, and that's why Judge Schmee and I did that, along with a former law clerk of mine, John Rosenthal, did that first article in 1991 in Notre Dame Law Review that connected therapeutic jurisprudence with drug treatment courts. I said, you know, academia has no idea that this is going on, and they really need to know. Now there's, of course, therapeutic jurisprudence courses in all kinds of places, including Auckland, New Zealand, taught by Warren Brookbanks. And you can go on the International Therapeutic Jurisprudence website and actually get curricula on TJ. So I felt, you know, we needed to get TJ out of pure academia and into a practical application, and we needed to get the courts that were only doing practical stuff into a jurisprudential foundation for what we were doing. And then that way we had the balance between, you know, town and gown, if you will. And but I really don't want to do another Law Review article. The last one I did was in Georgia Law Review. I'm still a drug court's senior judicial fellow, and I go around teaching and doing trainings. I am the judicial outreach liaison for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is certainly concerns about driving while impaired, but also distracted driving. We've now just developed a curriculum on drugged driving to distinguish between alcohol-impaired driving. So I'm still doing that work. I have 8 grandchildren who are the loves of my life, and yesterday I took my almost 8-year-old to see the Nutcracker, and we've had a lovely time. I'm a filmaholic, so I go see movies, and I read books like a crazy woman. And I have a great life. What can I tell you? If I could have written my life history, it would not have been this good. it's better than fiction.
How wonderful. Yeah. Well, that's why we, and Kim, we have, it looks like another hand up. Go ahead and open it up again.
Yes.
And go ahead,
Mark.
Yes, and anybody else that would like to ask a question, just remember to press 1 on your keypad.
Your Honor, I wanted to ask that you mentioned that you, when you were practicing, you didn't sit on this court all the time. You went back and handled things in a regular court. And I just wondered, is there a way for practitioners to utilize the kind of thinking and sort of general philosophy of these drug courts or these problem-solving courts and bringing it into the regular court system, and how would you recommend that be done, if at all?
Absolutely. There's a whole thrust going on of bringing drug courts to scale, which means that we really should all be operating with many of these principles most of the time. Certainly, the idea of therapeutic jurisprudence, being mindful of how you are affecting other people, especially from the judicial point of view, whether you make eye contact, whether or not someone feels they've had voice. And I don't care if it's a small claims case over $50, which to you is like the most boring case of your day. For those people in front of you, they are terrified to be there. They are so nervous they probably didn't sleep last night. And it's the most important thing of their month. And you have to be mindful of that. So that would be an example of applying a TJ principle in regular life of a court. And there's a million examples of that. So TJ is something that you can use as a lens for any court proceeding, any attorney proceeding. The way you interact with opposing counsel, the way you interact with your clients, all can be done that way. If you're talking about using more the treatment response kind of thing, I'll tell you a story. John McShane, is an attorney in Dallas, and he's public about this. I'm not disclosing anything. I shouldn't. He's a recovering alcoholic and also has suffered depression most of his life, to the point where he had to hide his gun one time because he thought he was going to use it, and he tells that story publicly. If he has someone come to him and the reason for them being there is their basic alcoholism, he tells them his story, and then he says, I won't represent you unless you get into treatment. And he has told wonderful stories about how his clients were helped, but also how other people were helped. So, for instance, in one story he tells of a vehicular manslaughter in which his client killed someone else while driving drunk. And he got him into treatment, got him into AA, and had him go to the graveside of his victim and write a letter. And when it came time, and he pled guilty, when it came time to sentence, he brought all this up and he had the client read the letter to the judge. And then the client turned around to the family and made his amends. And that kind of powerful story, that can be done anytime, any place, anyhow. You don't need a drug court for that. You just need that lens of saying, are people going to be better off having had contact with me than if they hadn't? And the worst thing we can do is as judges anyway, is be what Judge Lynn Edwards calls jurogenic. You know, the iatrogenic is the term they use for getting MRSA in the hospital. You know, you end up dead from the infection and you went to get a simple procedure done. Well, he says that judges hurt people in the same way and that's called jurogenic. So I think we have to be mindful that people come into courtrooms at their highest stress levels most of the time and that they're there for our help and therefore our intervention. And what we can do is either make that a long-term positive experience, even if they're going to lose, even if you're not going to rule for them, even if they're going to spend some time in jail or prison, you can still do it in such a way that long-term it's going to be okay.
Well, and I'll mention the Center for Court Innovation did a study recently, and it was something as simple as using the names of the people in the courtroom as
yes.
recognition and respect, and it was making a huge difference.
Yes, instead of just saying the defendant.
Yes, it's like the defendant dehumanizes the person sitting there.
Yes.
I think we have one more question, and then we're going to end. Molly, can you open up? Dorothy, yes.
Yes, yay. Hi, this is Dorothy Scher in Fort Worth, and I practice here in Fort Worth. And I'd like to ask, Judge, do you run for office, and is it necessary for you to align yourself with a particular political party and campaign and meet their guidelines for their candidates and placate them, I suppose is the word I'm looking for, in order to be a judge, or how does that work for you?
Yeah, excellent question, and the answer is yes and no. Every state does it differently. You know how it happens federally. You know, it's a presidential appointment and then confirmation. But different states do it different ways. In California, all trial courts are directly elected, but it's nonpartisan. So it's not you have a Democratic candidate and a Republican candidate. The courts of appeal in the Supreme Court stand for confirmation elections. So it's just up or down, shall we keep these people? Some are appointed in some states for life, for a certain term. Some are a combination of things. Some are highly partisan. And, in fact, there are some states where you can run against the Supreme Court members. Nevada, for instance, and I believe Tennessee are two of them. So there's different schemes in each state. I did not run as a political party, which was great, like I say, because I had both sides of the House supporting me. and it makes it easier that way. Once you win, however, as I did in 1984, you then have to stand election every 6 years, but no one ever ran against me. And I want to say one thing about good courts in the election context. I've been watching closely contested judicial elections to see if any drug court judges were getting taken on as being soft on crime or other things that people sometimes say about drug courts. And I can tell you, at least from the research I've been able to follow, not one drug court judge has ever been defeated because they were a drug court judge. And in fact, in one contest I was watching in a state where there were party elections, it was two Republican candidates going for the primary, and they were out drug courting each other. Well, I started it. Well, I supported it. You know, that sort of thing. And I just kind of had to giggle and say, wow, we've come a long way, baby. And I don't know quite how they do it in Texas, so I can't answer that. I know some you have non-law trained judges in a lot of places, because I just did a talk to some in Corpus Christi about a month ago.
Could I ask what state you work in?
Oh, I'm sorry, California.
Oh yes, okay.
San Francisco Bay Area. I was born in
well, good for you.
And I now live 15 miles away. So I travel
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, we have partisan elections. The elections in Texas are very partisan, and they get caught up in some of the actual Republican platform issues, which are sometimes contrary to the way we might want judges to be selected. Anyway, thank
and
you.
And judicial ethics, I might add.
Sorry?
And judicial ethics.
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, Judge Hora, we have come a long way, and you've been clearing that path as a trailblazer. So thank you. For
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
I haven't even gotten too much poison oak along the way.
Well, it sounds like it. It's agreed with you, and it certainly agreed with the rest of us. So I appreciate your being here and sharing with us and overcoming the technical problems that it took to get here this morning. And
I apologize again for that.
No problem.
Apologize.
No problem. And next, we're going to be off now until January 2nd. And on January 2nd, we're going to have Arnold Patton, who back in the 80s was one of the first people that Oprah recognized as one of her teachers. And so we're going to be he practiced law and was a businessman and then wrote a book called You Could Have It All. And so we're going to be hearing from him on January 2nd. And everybody have wonderful holidays in between.
And
thank you
for inviting
me on, Kim.
That's Hora. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I just want to remind people that they can find more information about your amazing body of work at judgehora.com. It's been just delightful and such an honor to host you today. Have a wonderful Christmas, everyone, and also remember that you can go to cuttingedgelaw.com for this archive and all other archives of past speakers and also a schedule of our upcoming speakers. And finally, for those of you who would like to have more information about a very special event that Kim is doing with former Amnesty International Director James O'Dea, that's upcoming this February in Colorado, and it's an intensive for lawyers like yourself. So if you're interested in that, you can also find more information at cuttingedgelaw.com. Thank you so much, everyone. It's been a pleasure. Merry Christmas and happy holidays. See you soon.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are currently the only person in this conference.